And our 21st Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. This week, we are dealing with the topic of male privilege. And joining me today via telephone from Washington, D.C., we've got Kate Black, who is the VP of Research for Emily's List. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, especially now. This is the middle of political bedlam there, I assume.
We are very, very busy. It's 11 days from Election Day, and we are all steam ahead.
All steam ahead, indeed. Well, fantastic. And again, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I guess we should give people a brief history of Emily's List, if you could.
Sure, happy to do it. So Emily's List has been around for over 30 years. We were founded in 1985. And Emily's List stands for Early Money is Like Yeast. It helps rise the dough. So there is no Emily, but rather there's a network of over 3 million people who are committed to electing pro-choice Democratic women up and down the ballot. So as you mentioned, it is very busy here, and that's because we are trying to elect Hillary Clinton to the very top of the ticket, but we're also working all the way down. We have Senate races, which we can talk about, House races, but we also have endorsed many women at the state and local level as well.
Fantastic. I'll tell you, the acronym I was not aware of. That's that was news to me. So
we started it in 1985 because mm-hmm. at that point, there was not a Democratic woman senator who had been elected in her own right. And one of the main reasons, and I think it still persists, that women candidates have had a harder time winning elections is because they don't have that access to capital that, frankly, male candidates often do. And so Emily's List really wanted to go in as almost that Kickstarter or angel investor to some women candidates to help build that early seed money, which then would snowball into stronger campaigns, more donors, more press attention, and ultimately being to communicate with voters, which we're seeing in these final days, as you know, is so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, politics has been a male-dominated field for a very, very long time, and it hasn't been, let's face it, it hasn't been even until since 1920 that women have had the right to even vote. So it's pretty pretty amazing when you consider the fact that better than half the population is women, that so few are in politics. How has this changed over the years? I know there are more and more women in politics. Here in California, we have both of our senators are women and have been for some time. How is that changing over the years?
So I think that's a great question, and I so appreciate the historical kind of setup that you provided. I think over the years we've seen, especially on the Democratic side, a significant increase in the number of women in office. Now, don't get me wrong, we're still less than 20% of Congress and about a quarter of state legislatures. But we are seeing significant gains. And I think, to be fair, you saw a dramatic spike after the creation of Emily's List and in 1992 when we elected 20 new women to the House and 4 new women to the Senate, including Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer that year. So I think we're definitely seeing an increase in the number of women who are stepping up to run and then win. But you mentioned this too about women voters. You're right, women are over half the population, and we are actually we're about 53% of total people that show up to vote. So we are the ones who make decisions in elections. And I think we just need more of us to not only vote, but then run and lead.
Well, this is a very interesting dynamic, especially this year, when you've got Donald Trump, who's running on the Republican ticket and is trailing very, very poorly with women. Not surprising, considering his treatment of women over the years and things he has said, but so much so that many of his supporters have started a hashtag, repeal the 19th Amendment. How do you respond to something like that?
You know, I saw that start on Twitter a couple weeks ago, and my response was, you know, frankly, I think this is a conversation that very few people are having, and women are very busy doing a lot of things between working, caring for our families, and ultimately starting to vote early. You know, we're seeing in some key states like Georgia, women are stepping up to vote early in extraordinary numbers. And I think part of that is because, you know, you mentioned Donald Trump's treatment of women, and this is a man who not only has bragged about sexual assault, but whose policies wouldn't actually help women. I think women saw a clear answer in response to Donald, which was at the ballot box.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's amazing. I mean, there has been you know, a dynamic for a number of years with regard to Republican versus Democrat with the female vote, but more so this year than I've ever seen ever.
Yeah, I think women are particularly engaged in this presidential election. You know, historically, we do see presidential election years have a higher turnout rate among all voters, but especially women. I think this presidential ticket on both sides has been really engaging about the conversation around women's issues and the their vote and how much it matters. So I'm not surprised that we're all talking about women voters at the high level that we are. Frankly, I hope that this conversation continues into 2017 and 18.
Now, obviously, one big thing is, and this is the first time ever that a woman candidate has been at the top of the ticket for a major party, and by all indications, it is looking very much so that that Hillary Clinton will win the White House. How big of a deal is this for women?
You know, I don't think there's any way we can overestimate the power that this will have for women and for men in this country. You know, I think on November 9th, I think millions of little girls are going to wake up and see a possibility that might not have been there for them. I think also millions of little boys are going to wake up and know that anyone can do anything. And I think for women in this country, we're going to have someone in the Oval Office who's, you know, been in our shoes a little bit. She has been the only woman in the room before. She's had to make the tough choices. She's had to speak up when it wasn't popular. And she appreciates, I think, the perspective that women and people of color bring to the table. And I think that's going to mean a lot, not only for our national dialogue, but also our society and culture moving forward.
It is. We are in historic times. We've seen now the witness of our first African-American president, and we were very close to having our first woman as president. One thing President Barack Obama has been criticized in is that he hasn't been strong enough for the African-American community. He said when he took office that he was going to be a president for all Americans, not just for African-Americans. But he has actually gotten some criticism from those in the African-American community that he hasn't done enough for the African-American population. What about Hillary, assuming she gets into office? Do you think there'll be pressure on her to expand women's issues?
So I'm so glad that you asked that question because it gives me an opportunity to really kind of talk about how I think the way that she has talked about women's issues as everyone issues. I think for Hillary Clinton, this campaign has been about certainly a focus on women, but also knowing that women care about good jobs and the economy being strong. Women care about immigration reform. Women care about national security. So I think one of the unique things that we will see in this next administration, hopefully, is that no matter what the issue she decides to put forward in those first 100 days and beyond, I think gender will be a component of that. That's a lens that I think she brings to the table And I'm personally, you know, really excited. Women's issues are not, you know, siloed into a corner, and rather they're front and center, because women do care about a variety of different issues, not just child care and paid family leave and access to reproductive health care, which are tremendously important, and I think, you know, we will certainly see those have a front seat in the administration as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would imagine so. Let us move forward with one of the main reasons that I actually picked this topic this time around, dealing with male privilege, was the actions of Donald Trump and the way he is able to get away with so many things. It seems, I mean, when the Access Hollywood video came out, it was jaw-dropping. But he seems to have just kind of sloughed that off as just a kind of locker room talk. And it seems like there's such a double standard with regard to men and women. I mean, if a woman who was running for office, if anything like that had come out, I think it would have been pretty much game over.
You know, I will agree, but I'll go one step further, that I think had any other Republican man who was running for president had this, it would be game over as well. And we could probably point to half a dozen other things that Donald Trump has done and said, maybe not just about women, but disrespecting veterans, making fun of Mexicans or the disabled. I mean, all of those in a different time or with a different candidate, we could expect to have been deal breakers.
Absolutely.
And so I think this election cycle is so interesting, and I'm sure there will be many academic studies about it moving forward. But it's so interesting in that Donald Trump, as a celebrity candidate, seems to be getting away with more than our traditional political narrative about what's acceptable would allow.
I would agree. I mean, I've had jokes with friends saying that he could you know commit murder, and you know his supporters would say, "Well, he's just doing what we all want to do." I mean, it's just like, it just seems kind of amazing. Now, speaking of you know candidates, you know all successful politicians have to be you know strong-willed and to get things done, to get things through office, to get things passed. You know, strength and leadership is important, no matter what one's gender. However, I have to ask you this, since you guys have been working with women's issues for so long. Oftentimes, strong women are referred to as, and I'm not going to use the word, as the B word, because they are women. But strong men are looked at as strong leaders. How do you guys get past that? Have you coached some of your other candidates on how to get past that issue?
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think it's something that, you know, society definitely has double standards for men and women. I don't think there's any secrets about that, and I also don't think that men and women who run for office are held to the same standards. That being said, I will say that I think our kind of dialogue about women's leadership and what it means to get things done, especially at the federal level, has really shifted over the last few years. I mean, it's not untrue that women in office in Congress are more likely to pass more legislation. They're also more likely to support legislation that is about education, healthcare, reproductive rights. You know, frankly, it has been women in office who have gotten things done in the last few years. You think about the budget shutdown, it was Patty Murray coming together with Republicans and saying, let's get a deal. It was Barbara Mikulski moving forward on all the appropriations bills. You know, I think we're seeing women at the federal level really step up and take a significant role in helping really move our country forward when it seems like all Congress might want to do is just partisan politics. And so while I agree with you that there is a double standard, I think we encourage women who are doing one of the bravest things that you can do, which is put your name on the ballot. You know, we encourage them to run smart campaigns to talk to voters about the issues that, that matter most to them, and focus on that.
Excellent. We touched a little bit about this a little earlier in the conversation, but I was just curious if you had some data on this. Since Emily's List went into effect and you've been helping candidates, what has been the percentage of growth in the, both the House and Senate with regard to the percentage of women holding office there?
You know, I don't have those figures on hand, but I will tell you that over the last, since we've been in I guess in formation since 1985, in the coalition for Democrats and Republicans, right now women make up about a third of the Democratic caucus,
mm-hmm.
And on the Republican side, they're nowhere near that. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Republicans just haven't done as good of a job of recruiting women to run and supporting them when they do. There's also no version of Emily's List on the Republican side. So there's no entity that's sole purpose is to encourage Republican women to step up and run and win in a concerted way that fundraises for them and helps their campaigns like we do. The other thing is that women, Republican women, have a hard time getting through Republican primaries. Sometimes Republican women, the ones that have run most recently, tend to be a little bit more moderate. And they have a harder time winning primary elections than getting into the general. So those are just a few reasons why I think you see a larger percentage of Democratic women in office than you do Republican women.
And one other thing is, it to me, it seems that more and more Republican Party policies over the years have been, for lack of a better word, anti-woman. They've been a lot of rhetoric dealing with reproductive rights and whatnot. That, I mean, quite frankly, I think is quite offensive. It would be, I think, it's almost antithetical for a woman to say, "Yeah, I support this."
You know, I think you're right. We see through some of the polling that we did this cycle, looking at specific issues, especially economic issues like equal pay, paid family leave, and affordable child care. We see Republican women voters very strongly supporting these issues, mostly because they don't see them as partisan. You know, when you also talk about protecting access to birth control, Republican women and independent women definitely support protecting that right. And so I think you're right to say that Republicans in office have certainly put forth proposals that I would say are not in line with where Republican women voters are. Republican women, and frankly women voters writ large, are looking for solutions and not partisan games. And I think they're seeing Democrats as being the ones who are offering them real opportunity.
I'll be honest, I feel actually sorry for moderate Republicans this go around, because they're lost. I mean, it has gotten to a point where it's so extreme, I just don't know what they're going to do or what the party's going to do with after this election cycle. It's kind of perplexing.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, I think we're reaching a tipping point. Certainly, this cycle has been one of the most extreme elections that we've had probably in our history. But we have seen this trend of Republican women, leaving office. I think Olympia Snow is a great example of a Republican woman senator who represented Maine for a long time in office, she left a few years ago mainly because the party was just moving so far to the extreme that she didn't feel like it represented her values anymore. We're also seeing a number of Republican women strategists and consultants come forward in the last few weeks to share their stories about how, they used to think that the, so-called war on women was simply a talking point, but they're finding out, as the cycle has continued, that it's not just a talking point, that it is actually Republicans in office and Republican candidates who just don't support the realities that women and their families are facing.
I have a prediction that that once the election actually happens, that there will be a lot of Republicans who will secretly and never say anything about it vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think that will be reflected once the count comes in. I think the win will be higher than initially predicted. At least that's what I think, because I've known plenty of Republicans who are just fed up, and they can't vote for Gary Johnson because of his lack of knowledge in foreign policies. The Aleppo thing was just one of those things that just was a tipping point. Many will either just stay away from the polls or, I think, secretly vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think when we see the final counts come in, it'll be fascinating to get a look to see on who voted where. I think we could see, on election night, a historic gender gap between men and women and who they vote for, not only at the top of the ticket, but looking at some of our key Senate races as well. Mm-hmm. I also think, Republican women could make some interesting choices for Hillary. I also think we are really interested in seeing how young women turn out and where they decide to, check the box. Young women are a unique and growing cohort of voters that I think we are very interested in making sure that we are not only talking to them intentionally about issues that matter to them, like equal pay and student loan debt, but also that we're kind of keeping them in the conversation and that they one day think of themselves possibly for running for office as well.
So this has been a hard-fought campaign, obviously. It's been one of the most interesting election years I've ever seen in my life. What do you think, what are the takeaways from this election cycle that future women candidates can take from this? Is there any lessons that can be learned from this round of elections?
I think, one of the things that we talked about over here is that this has really been a groundbreaking year. Not only are we making history with Hillary at the top, but also, we've endorsed Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada, who could be the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. Senate. We've also endorsed Kamala Harris, who would be only the second woman, African-American woman in the U.S. Senate.
She's running for Barbara Boxer's seat.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think there is a lot of history baked into this election cycle. But I think the other thing that we're taking away from it is that, I think Hillary is showing that it's okay to talk about gender. It's okay to have a conversation about body positivity. It's okay to talk about how the rhetoric and double standards are different. And that also it's okay to talk about issues that you know matter to women. In a way that has meaning for them. Women care about issues that are impacting them and their families, and I think time and time again, we're seeing gender play out in those issue conversations and dialogues.
Absolutely. Well, we are just about out of time, but before we wrap up, I want to ask you, Kate, if there is anything that we haven't touched on that needs to be covered.
The only thing I would just encourage your listeners to do is, if they haven't voted already, to make sure that they get out and vote. The power of women at the ballot box is huge this election cycle. I think we will see women voters show up and really decide for the country the direction that we're going to want to go in moving forward. Ultimately, I think it's a decision that's based on, if you trust women to make good decisions for themselves and their families, or you could go with Donald Trump. So I would encourage all of your listeners to get out and vote and make their voices heard.
All righty. Karen Black from Emily's List, thank you so much. I say Karen, Kate Black, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And this conversation for Stop the Violence will be up at khum.com shortly, along with all the conversations for the next 3 weeks.